Feast of the New Yam was held every year before the harvest began to honor the earth goddess and the ancestral spirits of the clan. New yams could not be eaten until some had first been offered to these powers. Men and women, young and old, looked forward to the New Yam festival because it began the season of plenty, the new year. On the last night before the festival, yams of the old year were all disposed of by those who still had them. The new yam must begin with tasty fresh yam and not the shriveled and fibrous crops of the previous year. All cooking pots, calabashes, and wooden bowls were thoroughly washed, especially the wooden mortar in which yam was pounded. Yam fufu and vegetable soup was the chief food in the celebration. So much of this was cooked that no matter how heavily the family ate or how many friends and relations they invited from neighboring villages, there was always a huge quantity of food left over at the end of the day. The story was always told of a wealthy man who set before his guest a mound of fufu so high that those who sat on one side could not see what was happening at the other. And it was not until late in the evening that one of them saw for the first time his in-law, who had arrived during the course of the meal and had fallen to the opposite side. It was only then that they exchanged greetings and shook hands over what was left of the food. The New Yam Festival was thus an occasion for joy throughout Umofia, and every man whose arm was strong, as the Igbo people say, was expected to invite large numbers of guests from far and wide. Okonkwo always asked his wife's relations, and since he now had three wives, his guests would make a fairly big crowd. But somehow, Okonkwo could never become as enthusiastic over feast as most people. He was a good eater, and he could drink one or two fairly big gulps of palm wine. But he was always uncomfortable sitting around for days waiting for a feast or getting over it. He would be very much happier working on his farm.
That was an excerpt from Nigerian author Chenwa Achebe's novel, Things Fall Apart. 2008 marked the 50th anniversary of the publication of this seminal novel. Its publication in 1958 was a significant literary and cultural event in Africa. Its popularity was derived from the mood of nationalist self-assertion that prevailed in Nigeria at the time, but also across the African continent. Things Fall Apart served to profoundly reorder the imaginative consciousness of Africa. It depicted an Africa that was delivering itself from the colonial yoke while drawing upon a new register of expressions that the influence of European languages had made possible. Chenwa Achebe has often recounted how the reaction provoked by negative representations of Africa in European literature led to his writing of Things Fall Apart. Since its publication in 1958, its appeal has only broadened in Africa and beyond, and the novel has lost none of its compelling force that derives not only from its engagement with the colonial encounter, but also from its reformulation of the inherited imperial language. We now turn to another excerpt from Chenua Achebe's Things Fall Apart.
Large crowds began to gather on the village Ilo as soon as the edge had worn off the sun's heat and it was no longer painful on the body. Most communal ceremonies took place at that time of the day, so that even when it was said that the ceremony would begin after the midday's meal, everyone understood that it would begin a long time later when the sun's heat had softened. It was clear from the way the crowd stood or sat that the ceremony was for men. There were many women, but they looked on from the fringes like outsiders. The titled men and elders sat on their stools waiting for the trials to begin. In front of them was a row of stools on which nobody sat. There were nine of them. Two little groups of people stood at respectable distance beyond the stools. They faced the elders. There were three men in one group and three men and one woman in the other. The woman was Mbafo and the three men with her were her brothers. In the other group were her husband Ozuolo and his relatives. Mbafo and her brothers were as still as statues into whose faces the artist has molded defiance. Ozuolo and his relatives, on the other hand, were whispering together. It looked like whispering, but they were really talking at the top of their voices. Everybody in the crowd was talking. It was like the market. From a distance, the noise was a deep rumble carried by the wind.
In September of 2008, the University of Toronto, similar to many institutions around the world, hosted a conference dedicated to exploring Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart on its 50th anniversary. The plenary address was given by Abiola Irele, visiting professor in the Department of African and African American Studies at Harvard University.
It is important, however, to note that the purpose Achebe ascribes here to his work with such clarity was formulated as the outcome of a reconversion of consciousness by which he came to reject the negative view of his African Igbo background that his upbringing in a Christian Protestant environment had instilled in his young mind, and which his early education within the colonial system had reinforced. Achebe has described the character of his early education and the damage to his self-image it implied. As he puts it, "I did not see myself as an African to begin with." You know, in fact, all these colonial novels depicting the savages and so on, it was later that he then saw that he took the side of the colonial. It was later that he then saw himself as part one of those savages, you know, dancing on the shores of the Congo. Now, given this testimony of an alienation provoked by his colonial education, there's a sense in which Achebe's writing of Things Fall Apart was not merely an act of cultural affirmation, an effort to rehabilitate what he was later to call the tarnished image of Africa, but also a deeply personal affair, a process by which he came to recover a less conflicted relation to his indigenous cultural inheritance, and thus to achieve a renovated personal self. And he has singled out, of course, the impact of Carey and Joseph Conrad, you know, and he attacked them in the image of Africa. But while his theme of cultural reclamation provides an initial entry into Achebe's first novel, it is important to read Achebe's Things Fall Apart not merely as testimony of the colonial encounter and as a repudiation of the discourse of empire, but as a complex work of fiction presents, a work marked by a full panoply of credible characters and even a memorable one, as in the case, for instance, of Okonkwo, and by its narrative poise, sustained by an assured deployment of a language appropriated, ironically enough, from the colonial master. Achebe presents a comprehensive picture of pre-colonial Igbo society in terms of structure, kinship system, economic life, governance, social and ethical values, and ultimately world vision. The picture we are presented with of the original state of this society is one of coherence and order, achieved as much through a remarkable adjustment to the natural world within which it is enclosed as by the constraining force of a social compact by which the collective exists regulated. A social compact sustained by religious feeling and reenacted in ritual and yearly festivals, imparting therefore to the communal life the quality of one long and uninterrupted ceremonial. The particular connotation of the name Achebe gives to the village, Umuofia, literally people of the forest, attests to the rustic way of life associated with the pre-colonial and pre-modern state, or estate, in fact, if you prefer. The forest here denotes a sylvan realm, an ecological sphere of existence of a people fully integrated into the natural environment. We need to bear in mind, however, that the image of Igbo society that the novel presents is not by any means an idyllic one, that the forest environment, constantly foregrounded in the various references to its fauna and flora, is one that is, if not hostile, at least challenging, indeed so intractable as to require a stubborn application of will for its domestication. It constantly determines the society's dominant scale of values and attitude to the world. No element of Achebe's representation of Igbo society conveys this feature of its collective life and apprehension more than the pride of place accorded to yam, the principal crop of its agriculture and economy, and the mainstay of the diet. Now, more than an item in the society's material order of life, yam assumes a centrality in the culture such that it comes to be endowed with a symbolic value that projects and underwrites the dominant values of his society. I quote here, "Yam is the king of crops, was a very exacting king. For 3 or 4 moons, he demanded hard work," and so on and so forth. It is thus an agrarian society that we're presented with, one that has patiently worked out a relation with the land from which it draws sustenance. A fact that is emphasized by the nature deities that inhabit its system of belief and the dominance in the collective imaginary of sacred places, in particular the caves and hills consecrated to Agbala, the earth goddess. It is against this background that we come to appreciate the vitality of family life and of the entire structure of personal relationships, founded as they are upon a system of obligations and solidarities that are charged with moral significance, to which one of the elders, Mwakibie, gives expression. We pray for life, children, a good harvest, and happiness. You will have what is good for you, and I will have what is good for me. Let the kite perch, and let the eagle perch too. If one says to the other, no to the other, let his wing break. So there's this reciprocity. At the same time, despite its collective emphasis, this is a society that affords considerable scope for individuality, for while it is not a perfectly egalitarian society, the hierarchy established within it is based on achievement, recognized by a sign that indicates the differentiated roles and status of its members. It is thus an image of an organic community, tightly knit by custom and well-attested rules and conventions, that Achebe presents.
The influence of Things Fall Apart has been significant, and it is still read today as a key text in post-colonial studies, African history, and English literature. The influence of Things Fall Apart is evident in the production of African novels today. And to quote Uzodinma Iweala, American-Nigerian author of the 2005 novel Beast of No Nation, Things Fall Apart, quote, made African writers like me possible. Achebe adapted the novel to a more African structure, one that allows for irregularities of the oral expression to shape the structure and furiously tackle colonial misconceptions of Africa as a dark continent without social structure. Elika Bemmer, professor of English language and literature at Oxford University and author of the novel Nile Baby and Bloodlines, speaks of the influence of Things Fall Apart in contemporary African writing and beyond.
Things Fall Apart generated an awareness in African writing that it was not only possible but imperative to take on colonial misrepresentations of Africa and those paradigms of us, them, self, other, on which such representations depended. So it wasn't surprising that from Things Fall Apart, a whole genealogy of writing ramified, most immediately in Nigeria itself, with the emergence in the 60s of a group of Igbo writers, including Nkem Nkwanko, Flora Nwapa, and Alechi Amadi, and arguably also the poet Christopher Okigbo. All these writers, cultural nationalists to an extent, organicists like Achebe to a degree, and the ones I mentioned, all Igbo, were interested in telling the stories of their village, their communities, using symbols of recognizably regional and local provenance. At the same time, through these village stories, they traced trajectories of national emergence through narratives of travail and overcoming, trajectories that in their case were rudely and tragically cut short by the national emergency that was Biafra. But the waves of influence emanating from Achebe's work at the levels not merely of ethnographic content, but of style, narrative, position, generic structure, epistemology, and these elements working together can also be detected in areas further afield, in Zimbabwean writing of the 1980s and 90s, thinking of Harvest of Thorns, in Papua New Guinean writing of the 1980s and after, as also in the work of the Samoan Alfred Wendt. And this is that's a particularly interesting connection to me. See, Things Fall Apart was put on the syllabus in Papua New Guinea in the main university there in the early 80s, and that generated a whole wave of Things Fall Apart inspired novels. The influence can be detected too, I'd suggest, in some of the ethnographic narratives of Aboriginal Australian writers. And even arguably, and though this would be a case of diffused and indirect influence, although we've heard this parallel already made today, we can detect the hand of Things Fall Apart in Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children, that dividedness to the vein, that Victor Ramraj was talking about in the previous session. As all this suggests, the topic of Achebe's influence posits any number of channels, contiguities, intertextual connections at local, regional, and international or transnational levels. The transmission of his influence reminds us, as Partamita has commented, of how diffuse and heterogeneous, as well as direct, uneven and cross-fertilized, as well as smooth, the transmission of influence can be. Standing at the head of arguably several genealogies of writing, as Things Fall Apart does, and as Achebe himself does, he has become a dominant point of origin, a kind of hyper-precursor, in whose aftermath many African authors self-consciously write, but arguably also numerous post-colonial writers. At the same time, they relate to his influence in diverse ways, deferentially or disruptively, embellishing or reducing, adapting incisively or tangentially, with strength or with weakness. Given this diffusion or even etiolation of influence, it remains difficult now, reading African writing after Achebe, to conceive of African writing in English without Achebe.
In the last 50 years, Things Fall Apart has not only had an influential effect on the literary scene, but can be marked as the genesis of the African novel in English. Chinua Achebe went on to write many other novels such as No Longer at Ease, Arrow of God, and Anthills of the Savannah. He has also written many books of poetry, short stories, and children's books. Chinua Achebe is also regarded as one of the most important critics of African literature and has been significant in criticizing racist perspectives of Africa. We leave you now with another excerpt from Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart.
The village crier was abroad again in the night. He beat his iron gong and announced that another meeting would be held in the morning. Everyone knew that Umofia was at last going to speak its mind about the things that were happening. Okonkwo slept very little that night. The bitterness in his heart was now mixed with a kind of childlike excitement. Before he had gone to his bed, he had brought down his war dress, which he had not touched since his return from exile. He had shaken out his smoked raffia skirt and examined his tall leather headgear and his shield. They were all satisfactory, he thought. As he lay on his babu bed, he thought about the treatment he had received in the white man's court, and he swore vengeance. If Umofia decided on war, all would be well. But he chose to be cowards. He would go out and avenge himself. He thought about wars in the past. The noblest, he thought, was the war against Isheke. In those days, Okudo was still alive. Okudo sang a war song in a way that no other man could. He was not a fighter, but his voice turned every man into a lion. This is a great gathering. No clan can boast of greater numbers or greater valor. But are we all here? I ask you. Are all the sons of Umofa here with us? A deep murmur swept through the crowd. They are not, he said. They have broken the clan and gone their several ways. We who are here this morning have remained true to our fathers, but our brothers have deserted us and joined a stranger to swell their fatherland. If we fight the stranger, we shall hate our brothers and perhaps shed the blood of a clansman. But we must do it. Our fathers never dreamt of such a thing. They never killed their brothers, but a white man never came to them. So we must do what our fathers would never have done. Eneke the Bard was asked why he was always on the wing, and he replied, "Men have learned to shoot without missing their mark, and I have learned to fly without perching on a twig. We must root out this evil, and if our brothers take the side of evil, we must root them out too. And we must do it now. We must bail this water now that it is only ankle deep." At this point, there was a sudden stir in the crowd, and every eye turned in one direction. There was a sharp bend in the road that led from the marketplace to the white man's court and to the stream beyond it. And so, no one had seen the approach of the five court messengers until they had come round the bend, a few paces from the edge of the crowd. Okonkwo was sitting at the edge. He sprang to his feet as soon as he saw who it was. He confronted the head messenger, trembling with hate, unable to utter a word. The man was fearless and stood his ground. his four men lying behind him. In that brief moment, the world seemed to stand still, waiting. There was utter silence. The men of Eumophia were merged into the mute backcloth of trees and giant creepers, waiting. The spell was broken by the head messenger. "Let me pass," he ordered. "What do you want here?" "The white man whose power you know too well has ordered this meeting to stop." In a flash, Okonkwo drew his machete. The messenger crouched to avoid the blow. It was useless. Okonkwo's machete descended twice and the man's head lay beside his uniformed body. The waiting backlog jumped into tumultuous life and the meeting was stopped. Okonkwo stood looking at the dead man. He knew Eumophia would not go to war. He knew because they had let the other messengers escape. They had broken into tumult instead of action. He discerned fright in that tumult. He heard voices asking, "Why did he do that?" He wiped his machete on the sand and went away.